Okay, good evening, everyone. Last week in our first session, we discussed the early phase of Reform Judaism in the first and second decade of the 19th century in Central Europe, and it became clear that in its earliest phase, the leaders were not theologians who had a coherent intellectual view of Reform, nor were they practical men who were able to implement a consistent policy, but rather they were men of action who wanted to implement some aesthetic changes in the synagogue service that would be appealing to enough of a constituency to have a congregation, which means you have to compromise and do things that are not necessarily whole-scale reform, nor are they entirely orthodox. They're neither sort of neither here nor there, a no-man's land of reform. But it was an impressive first start in Westphalia, in the Kingdom of Westphalia, in the city of Seesen, in the city of Kassel, and then the Westphalian consistory comes to an end because of the Napoleonic defeat. So, where does the reform go next? It goes to Berlin in 1815. Berlin, already for the previous generation and a half, was suffering from acculturation and apostasy. There were about 5,000 to 6,000 conversions to Christianity in Berlin between 1770 and 1830. Greater than in any other time in Jewish history, other than the forced persecutions in Spain in the 1400s, where there is, under pain of death, of inquisition and expulsion, but under lesser circumstances, basically benign circumstances, you don't find apostasy to that level anywhere other than in Germany in that generation, specifically in Berlin, where it was very bad. So the level of religiosity is on steep decline. The days of Moses Mendelssohn are long over, of the pious maskil. Just an example of the Yiridat HaDorot, the decline of the generations. In 1799, one of Mendelssohn's disciples, if you want to call him that, David Friedlander, who was one of the leaders of Berlin Jewry, volunteered to convert to Christianity, to the Lutheran Church, together with six other prominent Berlin Jewish families, on condition that they not have to accept the dogmas of the particular dogmas of the church, that they'll accept the victory of Christianity in its general sense over the other faith groups as being the faith of enlightened culture, but not having to accept the divinity of Jesus or anything along those lines. The pastor Teller in Berlin rejected this pseudo conversion as being a farce. You know, if you're either going to be a Jew or you're going to be a Christian. You can't be sort of halfway and call yourself a Christian for the advantages of emancipation and the like.
What was his good father's attitude towards Jews himself?
Not especially hostile, but he was defending the integrity of his faith group. Okay. Yeah.
Didn't you still need to get an head in academia?
Absolutely. And that's going to be important as we deal with some of the preachers in the early Reformed temple. One of whom, to get ahead, ends up apostatizing. Okay.
What was the level of religiosity of the people living there? Were they Orthodox or they were just...
So, most Jews in Berlin in the early 1800s were still traditional in their personal observance, meaning kosher and Shabbos was not flagrantly violated out in the open. But that number was noticeably declining, so that by the 1830s and 1840s, the percentage of truly observant Jews was very, very minuscule, a small minority. So it's a rapid decline. Now, in the 1815, Israel Jacobson moves to Berlin. Israel Jacobson was the man who founded the Seesen Temple in 1810 and was a leader of the Westphalian consistory. And he is a man of action. He wants to develop synagogues that are modern synagogues. And so he establishes one in Berlin in 1815, in particular because his son was having bar mitzvah and he wanted the service to be conducted in a fashion befitting an enlightened Jew like himself. Okay. It's in his own home. He's a wealthy man. He can accommodate a large crowd in his home. But eventually the crowd gets to be so large he can't do it in his own private residence. Move it over to the home of Jacob Hertz Beer, who was one of the wealthiest Jews of Berlin. And they say that there were as many as 400 people at one of the services in the early months of 1815. People who had not attended synagogue in decades came to these services. Why? They had been turned off by the old line synagogue of the mainstream community, the Orthodox synagogue of the community, and so they were not interested in going to those religious services. No one is coercing them. You can't force a person to go to shul. But if all of a sudden there's an alternative that is to the liking of the assimilated class, well, they might very well go. So here is where the partisan Reform Jew in the year 2017 will look back upon the history of the movement and say, hey, 200 years ago, Reform Judaism was not a step in the direction away from tradition, but rather it was a step in the direction back towards tradition. For people who were already alienated, now they had something they could latch on to that was Jewish. That's how the partisan reformer would look back upon history. And not entirely without merit. But the government doesn't like it. The government in Prussia is not interested in the flowering of a denomination of Judaism that is appealing to the acculturated class. What do they rather want for those Jews? To become Gentiles, to convert to Christianity. The Lutheran Church, or in southern Germany, the Catholic Church, they want for absolute schmad, apostasy, not the survival of a watered-down form of Judaism that looks like Christianity but is still Jewish. And so, what did the king do? He banned the Reform Synagogue of Berlin. Yeah. So this is government interference in the internal religious affairs of Jews. It will happen time and again throughout the 19th century. So Frederick Wilhelm III says, no more, can't do it. But the reformers got lucky. In 1817, the shul suffered significant damage, and they had to rebuild it. So in the absence of a functioning communal synagogue structure, there had to be services in private homes. Well, if you're going to have services in private homes, then the government can't really regulate what goes on in those private homes. So the Reform Synagogue was back in business in 1817. And it hired a preacher, not a rabbi, a preacher. His name was Edward Clay, who published a prayer book. And there were several other preachers who rotated through the congregation. Most famously was Leopold Zuns. Leopold Zuns is known to us for being the founder of the Wissenschaft des Judentum, the scientific study of Judaism, the academic study of Judaism. And he would have a long and illustrious career publishing works of great significance, studying rabbinics and classical Jewish history.
Can you define preacher?
So someone who is not an ordained member of the clergy, but who gets up and offers an edifying sermon on a weekly basis.
Like a magid?
Like a magid, except not a, of the Eastern European variety, the Central European variety. Yeah.
What was it about Berlin, Germany at that time? That created the proclivity of people to accept this reform.
I mean,
living
a
different
kind of population. So, in Germany, and notably in Berlin, the culture was regarded as a very lofty culture. And Jews were identified as being culturally backward until they adopted the ways of their heathen neighbors. And so having adopted the ways of their non-Jewish neighbors, they're also looking to have their religion be similar to the style of religious services they find in the church. Okay? And that manifests itself in the sermon, which previously didn't really exist, as we mentioned last week, synagogue music, choral music, the canonicals of the clergy, that they'll dress like a minister, and the architecture of the synagogue being more akin to a church than to an old-line shtiebel. So there are many ways in which the synagogue will resemble the house of worship of the neighbors, because the neighbors were seen as being this elite, cultural elite, and we want to be just like them.
Okay. There are shtibles, there are reform shtibles. How is the davening different? Did they have machitzas?
Okay, so when the synagogue eventually will be built in Berlin, there is separate seating, but no machitza. There will be plenty of Hebrew, but also plenty of German. We'll get to the details of the service soon enough when they try to defend, on halachic grounds, their innovations. Okay, so...
Who wrote that?
Who wrote what?
Who wrote this defense?
Eliezer Lieberman. We're going to speak about him and what kind of character he was, whether he was a charlatan or he was an honest fellow. All right. So, Leopold Zunz, as I said, was the great figure in the academic study of Judaism in its earliest phase. And in 1819, he got together with some of his buddies to found the Society for the Culture of the and Scientific Study of the Jews, the Verein für die Wissenschaft des Judentum. It didn't last very long. It lasted only about 6 years, and it published a limited amount of material. But some of its members were very famous, two of whom became Christians, Heinrich Heine and Edward Gans. Why did they become Christians? To seek entry into the wider world, which was denied to them by virtue of their Jewish birth. What was the purpose of the scientific study of Judaism? So in its beginning, the claim was that by studying Judaism in a rigorous way, in an academic way, it could be properly determined what is the core of Yahadut and what is marginal in Yahadut, and therefore keep the core and throw away the chaff, you know, get rid of the aspects of our religious heritage that are later accretions of limited worth, if you could say such a thing. Chas v'sholom. So, the most important accomplishment in this respect, in the earliest phases of academic study of Judaism, was the defense of the sermon. Zunz's book, Hadrashot b'Yisrael, Hadrashot b'Yisrael, the sermons in Judaism, or in Israel, was published in 1832 in German originally, and was not translated ever into English as far as I know. It was translated into Hebrew by Chanoch Albeck in the 1940s maybe, and so whatever I've read from it is from the Hebrew translation because I can't read the German. And it is an excellent work in which Zunz goes through the Midrashic literature and proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that this is not a book. The Midrash is not a book. What is the Midrash? It is a later. It is a collection after the fact of real life sermons that were delivered in synagogues by preachers in Eretz Yisrael between the 3rd and 8th centuries. So that there was a drasha on a regular basis for the Parshot HaShavua, for the Chagim, for special occasions, and that equals the Midrashic corpus that we have on the shelf. And so, therefore, if the sermon is introduced into the synagogue in Germany in the 1820s and 30s, that is not an illegitimate reform or innovation. What is it? It's l'hachazira tarah liyoshna, to bring back the glory that was, that there always should have been sermons. That what do the people need? The people cannot be satisfied with prayers in a language they don't understand, and the reading of the Torah in the original Hebrew that they don't understand. They need an edifying sermon in the vernacular that will lift them up spiritually and give them a little Yiddishkeit in a way that is palatable to them.
Was this all allegorical then? All these sermons?
No, not necessarily.
They were intellectually...
Well, I mean, have you ever learned the Midrash cover to cover? Like, I mean, most people never study Midrash. Most people hear aspects of the Midrash in their study of the Mefarshim on the Chumash, mm-hmm. or when the rabbi gives a sermon, he quotes the Midrash. But if you actually read it cover to cover, some of the Midrashic works, like the Midrash Rabban Tanchuma, read like, not a long commentary on the Torah, but specific homilies about one verse, one line, and a moral lesson that was developed, that you could see was developed in stages and could have been a 15-minute speech. Okay, so that's what Zunz is trying to defend, that the sermon is not an innovation, it goes back to ancient times.
What's the
the major problem of having a sermon, except that it takes time.
You know what? We're not in the 1820s, so we can't understand what the objection might have been, other than that the traditional rabbis don't have a historical consciousness, to be honest, even to this day. In the Orthodox world, most rabbis don't have a historical consciousness. They're not aware of the past. They just know their generation and maybe the previous generation. And so whatever is done now or was done in my father and grandfather's time is legitimate. And whatever was done 300 years ago, I have no idea what happened 300 years ago. So therefore, it's like it never happened.
And that sermon was on Shabbos HaGadol.
Right.
And Shabbos Teshuv.
So any departure from that is suddenly treif.
Was there a halakhic problem?
No, not at all. Okay. So the defense of the Berlin synagogue was written by a man named Eliezer Lieberman. He was a Hungarian Jew who had a yeshiva education, and he wrote a book called Or Noga, The Radiant Light. And he appended to that Noga HaTzedek, the righteous radiance, in which he collected Teshuvot responsa from three other rabbis justifying some of the changes in the synagogue practice. So let's examine what it is that he was defending. And I was in the YU library a couple of weeks ago. I took out this Noga HaTzedek, and no one had touched it since 1948. It's fun. Okay, so Lieberman says the pious, the pietists, have many complaints about reform services, and he lists nine of them. One, use of vernacular language means abandoning Hebrew, the language of creation, of our national history, and therefore to be frowned upon. Moreover, the halacha says, asur lishanut mimatbeah shetavu bo chachamim, it is forbidden to change the formation of the liturgy, the matbeah, the coin, the phraseology of the liturgy as established by the ancient sages. And if you're going to use the vernacular perforce, you have to change the matbeah, because I can't say Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech HaOlam exactly in English as I would say it in Hebrew. The meaning is always going to necessarily be a little bit off. Translation is never perfect. It's always an art, not a science.
But didn't Rambam say that you can in the vernacular?
Oh, okay. All right. So he's going to have a defense, trust me. That's going to be part of the defense. So the first issue is the vernacular language and the changing of the matbeah. The second complaint that people had was the elimination of the silent amida, that there was only the repetition, except it's no longer a repetition because it's the only one. The third complaint is the skipping of the Kedusha in Shacharis of Shabbos. Now, why would they skip parts of the Kedusha? Because the in Shacharis and Shabbos, there's too much Tzion. If you Mimkomcha Malkeinu Tofia, if you're a non-Zionist, it's hard to say that. Okay. The fourth point, the organ, the use of the organ. The fifth point, the Berlin Synagogue adopted the Sephardic pronunciation of Hebrew and forgot about the old Ashkenazic pronunciation of Hebrew. The sixth complaint, they abolished the trup for reading the Torah. The Torah was read in the standard voice, just as you would read a paragraph out of a plain text, but not with the Tamei HaMikra. The seventh complaint, it's a Chil Hashem to advance factionalism in Judaism. Lo tidgodedu, do not create factions. And here, this is a breakaway, a shanda, a breakaway from the main shul. Okay. The eighth complaint, if the earlier and great ones did not do these things, how could we, the lesser ones of more recent times, do these things? And there is a famous citation from the Talmud, Im harishonim kivnei adam, anu kivnei chamor. If the earlier ones were like the sons of man, we are like the sons of donkeys. And if we are like the sons of man, the earlier ones were like the sons of the malachim. In other words, there's no comparison between us and those who came before us. They were the great ones, the great and holy and pure ones, and we are much less down, lower down on the scale of holiness. Okay, so let's get some answers. On the first point, a vernacular prayer, Lieberman had some good answers. First of all, there's a Mishnah. Elu ne'amarin b'chol lashon. The following things can be said in any language. Kriyat Shema, the recitation of the Shema. Tefillah, meaning the Shemona Esrei, the Amida. Ubirkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. So, although we're not typically in the habit of reading those things in English or other languages, if you really wanted to, you could. You'd have to make sure that the translation was accurate, or as reasonably accurate as you could do, but you could do it.
Well, there's one caveat.
You have to understand it, right. So Hebrew works even if you don't understand it. The vernacular works only if you understand it. All right. Another point. Rashi on the Gemara. Tfilah b'chol lashon lo tzarich kra. The proof that you can pray in any language does not require a scriptural verse. D'haracha meinihu, because this is supplication for mercy. V'haholishna d'yad l'chaven libo litzli, and whatever language you know to have the feelings of your heart come out, that's the language in which you should pray. In other words, it's such an obvious point that you can pray in the language that you understand, that we don't need a biblical verse to prove it. It's that obvious. It's Rashi. Okay. Another line is in the Yerushalmi. Uveirachta. So, v'achalta, v'savata, uveirachta. You eat, you should be satisfied, and you shall bless. Shiehe mevin l'misha atam avarech. That you should understand about whom and what to you, whom you are blessing and what you are blessing. So there has to be comprehension in Birkat HaMazon, which, by the way, makes a lot of sense, because what is Birkat HaMazon? It's an expression of appreciation for the bounty which God gives us and allows us to fill our stomachs. And so, if we were to just mumble words after the meal, we really have not expressed that appreciation. We've just mumbled words in a foreign language. So, you should understand it. Okay. Then he quotes the Rambam. The Rambam explains in Hilchot Tefillah, the laws of prayer, why it is that the Shmona Esrei even exists. What's the point of the Shmona Esrei? Well, we have an obligation to pray daily, at least in the eyes of the Rambam. It's a biblical law. That you have to pray every day. The other Rishonim disagreed and said there's no biblical obligation to pray, but praying is a good thing. Now, the question is, how are you going to do it? So the Rambam gives a quasi-historical explanation and says that in the good old days, when the Jewish people in the land of Israel spoke Hebrew as their spoken language, as their day-to-day language, it was possible for the common man to articulate his feelings in a quality language, in Hebrew, and really say what he feels in his heart, even without guidance from the religious authorities. That on your own, you could come up with an impressive prayer. Everyone is the doctor of their own liturgy. But what happened? After the Babylonian captivity and the return to Eretz Yisrael and the Second Commonwealth, so what language did the Jews speak?
Persian.
Nothing. Gibberish. It's like to certain immigrant groups in America who don't speak English well and don't even speak their own language well. So the Jews in 4th century BCE, Eretz Yisrael, spoke a butchered Hebrew and a butchered Aramaic, or a butchered Persian. They were not able to express themselves well in any language. And therefore...
Pidgin language.
Yeah, a jargon. Okay, so eventually in Bayit Sheni, most Jews would speak a fluent Aramaic, a Western Aramaic, and or jargon Greek, a Koine Greek, the Greek of the marketplace. So, in order to give people an opportunity to pray in a clear and impressive language, what did the sages do, says the Rambam? They ordained the language of the Shmona Esrei. So now you no longer had to come up with a prayer on your own. It was set down for you. All you had to do was memorize it or read it out of a manuscript. Okay, so what then is the point? We want to be able to pray in a language that is understandable and in a way that allows us to express the feelings of our heart. So, for the Jew of Second Temple times, if the Shmona Esrei in Hebrew was laid out for them, they could say it and they could reasonably understand it. They couldn't come up with it on their own. They need the help of the sages to do it, but they could understand it. Whereas the Jew of 19th century Germany, who doesn't have much of a Judaic education, and certainly when it comes to comprehension of rabbinic Hebrew or biblical Hebrew, it's very weak. What do they need to do? Forget about the Hebrew of the Shmoneh Esrei, say it in the language they know. Okay. Another point. He quotes the Shailos Hatshuvos Dvar Shmuel. You could even say Kaddish and Kedusha in any language. Have you ever heard someone say Kaddish in a language other than Aramaic? Never. I never heard such a thing. Even the Reformers didn't do that. Why? Because the Reform wasn't always so consistent. Well, forget Kedusha for the moment. Kedusha, they do holy, holy, holy. I remember my grandmother told me that in 1944, in Boston, for the Yomim Noraim, she and my grandfather walked from Beacon Street near the Boston Common down to Harvard Street and went to the big Reform temple, and they asked my grandfather to take off his hat, and he was thrown for a loop, and then they heard holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and they ran out of there as fast as they could, went back home and didn't go to shul at Yom Kippur. Okay, so but Kaddish, they never changed. And why not? Because, as I said, the reforms were not absolute. Certain things that had an emotional hold over the people were preserved in the old form. And Yitgadal v'yitgadah Shemei Rabbah, nobody's going to get rid of that. Even for the most distant Jew, that still had some resonance. Okay. Yeah, it's true. Having just officiated at a funeral with not especially pious Jews, I can tell you it's still true. Yeah. That's a very good question. Obviously, the Orthodox rabbinate in Central Europe is not going to accept his say-so and his Talmudic analysis. But he's trying to convince the lay people who are nominally traditional and don't want to be seen as heretics that there is justification for the innovations of these newfangled synagogues. But this will only last a half a generation at most. Because within a decade or two later, the lay people who are interested in a new style synagogue couldn't care less about Talmudic justification. So this is a transitional period that doesn't last very long. But it's important for our study of history to show that it did happen. That in the year 1818, people actually cared about this stuff. By 1838, they don't care. 1818, the lay people still care.
Wasn't the Shmoneh Esrei articulated by the Archbishop?
Knesset Agdola, correct.
So that was what period was that?
In the 4th century, 3rd century BCE.
4th century.
Okay. So,
was it attending at this time as well?
Women?
Yes.
Okay, so women loved the new synagogue. Because, as I said, Jewish education was minimal, but whatever existed was more for the boys than there were for the girls. So the vernacular was absolutely necessary to sustain the interests of the women, and having introduced it into the service, the women formed the preponderance of the attendees. There were more women upstairs in the balcony than there were men downstairs. They really liked it. It was to their advantage.
That was the same as in Eastern Europe for the women. They had their own synagogue.
Right. So the Trino booklets of Eastern Europe were an alternative to the Hebrew of the traditional prayer book.
Yeah, but they weren't up in the
family. No, they were in the home. They were in the home.
Next to the Shabbos.
Right, right, right. Okay, so one of the questions that comes up was, well, okay, you can defend vernacular prayer, but maybe that defense of vernacular prayer only applies to the private individual, the yachid. But as for the congregation, the synagogue, that you shouldn't tamper with. That should be in Hebrew. So to this, Lieberman had a response. And he quoted from the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, "Bechol l'shonot yacholid palel, af b'yachid, rak lo ba'arami." You could even pray as an individual in a foreign language, and all the more so as a congregation. The only language you can't use, Aramaic. Why Aramaic? Because the Malachim have an unpleasant relationship with Aramaic, and therefore we wouldn't have the Machnisei Rachamim, the heavenly host, helping us get our prayers up to God. Okay. They didn't know Aramaic, yeah. True, we have a few things in Aramaic, but those are not the statutory prayers. Those are other things. Okay. The Beis Yosef also. The Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, says, Yacholi palel b'chol lashon sheyirtzeh, v'hani mili b'tzibur, even the congregation can say vernacular prayers. So don't try to make an arbitrary distinction between the private individual and the community as a whole. Okay. What about abolishing the silent Shmona Esrei? So here, Lieberman quoted the Radvaz, who said, it's a shanda what happens in the synagogue during the repetition of the Shmona Esrei. What do people do? They talk about whatever they want. Now, why? And these are people who take davening seriously, in that they recited the entire Lachash, the silent Shmona Esrei, every last word from Hashem Asfatai Tivtach to Kadmoniot. They said every last word. But what? They're done. And when the Chazan gets up there to say his thing, it's not my thing, it's his thing. So I'm going to talk to the guy next to me. And what happens if the Gentiles walk into the shul during Chazaras HaShatz and they see the Jewish people disgracing their own service? It's a horrible Chilul Hashem. It's an embarrassment that the heathens think that we don't treat our sanctuary with sanctity. Whereas they, in their church, would never think to utter a peep during the pastor's sermon or during the Lord's Prayer, whatever else they say. Okay? So, for that reason, it's a good idea to get rid of the Lachash. And he quotes the Rambam, who in Egypt in the 12th century did away with the Lachash for this very reason of bad decorum during the communal prayer. Okay.
How long did that play out?
I don't know. I'm not sure it survived his generation.
In the Sephardic. Yeah.
But real Sephardim, yeah.
Do they say Lachash?
Yeah, sure.
And
for Musaf, yeah.
But it's not the Lachash.
Well, the Lachash is Belachash. The out loud is... well, all right. So.
I think it's Belachash.
Yeah. Okay. The next problem. What about eliminating the trup? Eliminating the trup. You know, it's been a tradition for centuries and centuries. The Tamei HaMikra, how could you get rid of it? Now, why did they get rid of it? So they got rid of it because it smacked of Orientalism. Anything that sounded like the Middle East, like another environment, non-European, had to be done away with. We need to create a European synagogue that is not going to be an embarrassment if an outsider walks in. So we'll read the Bible like we read poetry, but not with the Mapach Pashta Zakev Katon. So what does Lieberman say? Who knows how Moses read the Bible? Those are his exact words. Mi yodea ech nishma Moshe. We don't know how Moses sounded when he read the Torah. Okay, so, I mean, it's a non-answer. It's an answer of, it's an evasive answer.
That kind of non-answer also has a second. What kind of alphabet did they use compared to
the Moshe? So when we get to the pronunciation, that'll also be an issue. The use of Sephardic pronunciation.
You know, the Persians have a different
right, it's the names of the Tamim are not the same, and they certainly don't sound the same.
Sound.
Right, the sound is very different, yeah. So, what about Sephardic pronunciation? So, why did they adopt the Sephardic pronunciation? The argument is that it's more authentic, and that the Ashkenazic pronunciation sounded like the ghetto. It had a sound to it that reminded people of a bygone pre-emancipation era. Whereas the Sephardic pronunciation sounds like a real ancient language, a dignified language of antiquity.
Was that the ideological precursor to the adoption of Sephardi over Ashkenaz in Israel?
No. If you remember last year, we learned that Eliezer ben Yehuda's biography, it was a complete fluke. One day he was sitting in Tunisia in a hospital, and he heard the guy next to him daven in the Miftah Sfaradit, and he loved it. And he decided to ask his Goyish friends, which sounds better? And the Russian friend said, oh, the Sephardic one sounds better. So Eliezer ben Yehuda said, oh, that's what we're going to go with. And the rest is history, 120 years later.
Wow. But speaking for myself, I would think that the accent in Passaic or in Baroque, I would have a similar point of view as to the cultural level of Baruch Atah Hashem.
Brief.
Okay,
yeah.
You see that?
Okay.
So you agree with
that? So Lieberman goes on to say. Lieberman goes on to say that one of the proofs of the superiority of the Mivtah Sfaradit or the Mivtah Temanit over the Ashkenazim is that every letter should logically have its own sound, and every vowel should have its own sound. There should be no redundancy. Yet in Ashkenazic pronunciation, is there redundancy? Sure. There's the sin and the samach and the saf. Three different letters sound the same way. That has to be wrong, he says.
Aleph and the ayin.
Yeah. So he claims we're doing the right thing here. Okay. Next point, and this is maybe the most controversial. The orgel, the organ. Musical instruments in the synagogue. So, the problem is that it's being played on Shabbos. And there's a halacha that in Menag de Mekle Shir b'Shabbos, you're not allowed to play a musical instrument on Shabbos. What malacha is it? None. So why is it forbidden? It's forbidden, Shema Yitakein Kalei Shir, lest you fix a musical instrument. That in the olden days, things broke down very easily, the string snapped, and you'd have to tie it, you do the malacha of kosher, of tying a knot. So because of the real, very real possibility of fixing the implement, you shouldn't play it in the first place.
So that would be like the shofar.
Well, the chauffeur's a little different because you're not...
fix it on Shabbos. I mean,
how are you going to fix it?
You stop up the hole or whatever it is.
It's possible if you do that.
Oh.
Yeah, so... It's got to be... Yeah. So, what's his defense here? Well, was there any precedent for music in the synagogue? The answer is yes. In Prague. So, in Prague, there was an organ. Except that in Prague... The organ was shut down on Friday afternoon at sundown as they were about to recite Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbos, in keeping with the halachic tradition that when you say the Mizmor Shir, that is now the official acceptance of the sanctity of Shabbos, where malacha and all the forbidden things are now in force. So, music is nice, but you have to play by the rules. So what is Lieberman's response? He says, there are no rules. Shema Yitaken Klei Shir is a joke. How is it a big joke? Well, are you allowed to clap your hands on Shabbos? Okay, so Talmudically speaking, you're not allowed to clap your hands on Shabbos. Are you allowed to dance on Shabbos or Yom Tov?
No,
you're not allowed to. On Simchas Torah, we're all doomed. We're dancing, and so it's all forbidden. Okay, so what does Tosfa say about the fact that we do clap our hands or dance on the Sabbath and festivals? He says the following: Aval bizmanenu kein osim, ein anu bekiyim b'asiat klei shir. We're not experts in the manufacturing of musical instruments. Umilsad lo shchicha. It's not a common occurrence that it'll break and that I'll fix it. So since we don't fix things, since we're not capable, we're not artisans who know how to do this, at best I can play the guitar, play the piano, but I'm not fixing it if it breaks. I'll call the guy after Shabbos. Therefore, maybe it's okay. So the argument is, if Tosfos changed Talmudic law to allow dancing and clapping, then I, Lieberman, in 1818, can say that music from an instrument is also okay for the very same reason. That we're not going to fix anything, it's all big bluff, and since it's not a malacha, just go ahead and do it. But that's only one explanation.
Well, wasn't the organist a non-Jew?
Ah, okay. So now we get to the issue of Amir al-Nachri, telling a non-Jew to do a prohibited action on Shabbos. If the organist was a Gentile, then what's the big deal? It's Amira Lanachri, and Amira Lanachri telling a Gentile to do something forbidden is permitted if it's for the sake of a mitzvah. What mitzvah? The mitzvah of having organ music in shul. Now, how is that a mitzvah?
Enhancing the
prayer, correct. So the musical accompaniment of the prayer is a noticeable enhancement that elevates the kavana of those assembled in the synagogue. Therefore, it rises to the level of a religious act.
But can't you say, though, that because the church is known for having organs, that would be...
You're right. It's the very next point. Okay, so are we mimicking the heathens? Uvechu koteem lo teilechu. Don't follow in their ways. So there are several answers to this that Lieberman offers. Number one, it's not their ways, it's our way. They stole it from us. Why? Because in the temple there was klei shir, there was the magrefa, which he says was like an organ. It was a multi-sound instrument with different keys. And he quotes the passage in the Tosefta and in the Yerushalmi that speaks about how there were 10 different keys, each key played 10 different notes, there were 100 different notes. It was a sophisticated instrument. That's the Magrefa. Moreover, this was not just an ancillary aspect of the service in the temple. That Ikar Shira, the main aspect of song, was what? Bapeh or Bakli? By the mouth or by the musical implement? It's a machlokis in the Talmud. One opinion says it's bapeh by mouth of the Levium, but another one says it's by means of the instrument, which goes to show you that the musical instruments are very central to the divine service.
Was this only on Shabbos, or was this?
This is generally speaking. In temple days, it's before they were dinim the rabbanim, so they probably could do it on Shabbos too.
Because
of kol shofar, we lift name Malach Hashem. Yeah. Okay. So the Amir Lenachri can be done away, can be ignored because it's for the sake of a mitzvah. What mitzvah? Enhancing the service. Is it b'chul koteim? No, because we did it first. Moreover, even if we didn't do it first, even if we wanted to concede as fact that we're consciously copying the Christians, that they do it, we like it, we think it's aesthetically impressive, and we want to do it too. So it's a conscious mimicking of the outside world. He would argue it's still allowed. Why? Because it's not a religious act, the playing of an instrument, in the sense of being directly associated with a foreign god or a foreign faith. It's objectively a nice thing that is used in the service of religion, their religion and our religion, but it's not inherently religious. It's just an accompaniment. It's an accoutrement of religion. So, therefore, B'chukoteihem only forbids that which is immediately directly related to a theological error. Music is not a theological error. It's just something that humanity likes. They liked it first and will like it second, but it's okay. That's his argument. By the way, is that the universally accepted definition of a chukoseihem? No. The more rigorous explanation of a chukoseihem is that anything that they do in their service of religion, even if the act itself is not inherently religious, automatically is forbidden if they do it first and we're consciously copying them. Therefore, music, the organ in the church, would mean that an organ in the synagogue is not allowed. Yeah.
Why
not? The issue of clapping is not about music. That's not the same thing as kleshir. Clapping and dancing were forbidden because they're associated with the revelry that accompanies the playing of music. It's not that the clapping itself was the music.
Oh, okay. Now, what about the notion that since the construction of the Beit HaMikdash,
okay. All right. So to that, Lieberman doesn't offer a very good answer at all. The question was, music in the post-temple era was frowned upon, if not outright forbidden, as a matter of zecher lechorban, that we are in a perpetual state of sadness over the loss of the temple, and therefore we don't become very boisterous and excited together with music.
So the
objection to eating meat, the Talmud chastises as being an extreme measure of the uber Pharisees, and they were wrong to do it, and it's okay to eat meat. But it is on the books that music that is secular is bad in the post-temple era because we're mourning the loss of the temple.
So it goes for yeah. Here. Many people who hold that Akasa in Jerusalem
itself
cannot have music.
Right. Yeah.
Because
right. Okay. So the answer to this question, which is not supplied by Lieberman, but would be supplied by other authors defending Reform practice, is that we're no longer mourning the Churban, that we've entered into a new phase, and the temple in Berlin is called the temple for a reason. It's the temple. We're not anticipating the reconstruction of a temple in Jerusalem. Now, the original use of the term temple was not necessarily to say that we're rejecting a return to Zion. That will eventually become a staple of Reformed theology. The original reason was that the temple is a universal house of prayer. Beit Tfilah Yikareh L'chol Ha'amim, in the words of Isaiah, and in the words of Solomon at the dedication in the Book of Kings, he says that he wants this to be a place where humanity can come to worship God. And so the idea of Israel Jacobson was, yes, this is a synagogue, it's a house of prayer for Jews, but I want it to be welcoming to anyone who would step foot in the doorway, even a Christian or someone of no denomination, can approach the Almighty in this universal temple. That was the idea. Okay.
Well, they did allow Goyim to do sacrifices in the Beis Hamikdash.
Yeah, that's true. That's sure. true. Okay.
So the
last point about the organ is that Lieberman says Ashkenazic Jewry has been failing in its service of Hashem by the standards of the Bible, of the Tochacha. What does it say? Tachat asher lo avarta tashem lekecha b'simcha uvetuv levav merov kol. That you didn't serve God b'simcha uvetuv levav, in a state of rejoicing and gladness of heart. That if you worshipped at all, it was like a somber and morose kind of thing. And yeah, non-Hasidic Ashkenazic prayer can be somber and morose. Okay? Dry at best, and there are other ways to describe it that are less, appealing. Okay, so what does he say? We are now improving the manner of worship, and it should be besimcha. And because our status as citizens of a free society is now emerging with the emancipation or the long sought emancipation, we can actually pray in a state of joy. We're no longer a downtrodden, beleaguered people on enemy territory. We're going to be free citizens, and so we can pray in a happy state, and that's what we should. And how do we do it? With the music. The music helps us achieve that joy. Okay. So those are some of the answers that he offers to these various questions. He then attaches to his book, the Noga HaTzedek, three rabbinical opinions that favor the actions of the Berlin Temple. And where did he get these rabbinic opinions from? So bear in mind that Berlin is in Prussia, in Germany, and there are plenty of rabbis in Germany, plenty of big rabbis in Germany, or in the related Habsburg Empire, Austria. But where does he get support from? He can't find it in Germany. No rabbi is willing to go out on a limb and say that these innovations are legit. So he goes to Hungary, to Arad, in a distant part of Hungary, where Rabbi Aaron Koroner is the rabbi. Aaron Koroner. Now, Aaron Koroner, his name, there would be two plays on his name. One, kor, like a kor shul, a choir shul, that he was in favor of a shul that had a choir, so he was like that his name indicates that he was a reform rabbi. Alternatively, Choriner, he was Ben Chorin. Ben Chorin in the sense of like free and not bound by the rules. So a friar, a friar yid. So that's one opinion. And the other two were Italian rabbis from Verona and from, from Padua. Why did he get these Italian rabbis? Because he can't find anybody else. And the Italian rabbis had a long tradition of being lenient on halachic matters. Italy has a glorious history, glorious Jewish history, but not one of great Talmudic scholarship. It had rabbis, including somewhat famous ones, but they were always lenient in areas of halacha. They were never the machmirim, they were always the mekilim. So Lieberman found three rabbis who were mekilim, who were willing to give him some material to work with.
Where was this
Choroner from? Arad, which is, I think, in southeast Hungary, not far from like the Yugoslav border, like all the way over, middle of nowhere, Jewishly speaking. So, what did Choroner say? As for the organ, he regarded the organ as an example of mitukanim shebahem. What are mitukanim shebahem?
Sweetening candy.
So, metukanim, l'taken, to fix something that is good, something that is improved. We are not allowed to copy the ways of the heathens, but that is only concerning matters where they are musrachim, they are repulsive, repugnant, religiously so. But whereas metukanim shebahem, those things that they do better than we do, we're allowed to and supposed to mimic their ways. Betukanim shebahem. And so he regarded music in the house of worship as an example of betukanim shebahem.
What support do three out of the way rabbis really give some
nothing. Which is so. Next week, when we discuss the Orthodox backlash, we'll read the first ever document of Orthodoxy, Eile Divrei Habrit, which was put together by the Hamburg Beit Din in reaction to the Hamburg Temple, which is the next big Reform temple. So they'll say these three rabbis are nobody from nowhere. Like, you know, we're the big Gedolei Hador. We have the right to boss people around and determine what is Judaism, and these three guys are irrelevant. Okay, so the other thing that Charner says is, as for Bitul Tefillat Lachash, getting rid of the silent Shmona Esrei, Eit Lasot Lashem Heferu Toratecha. The time to act for the Lord, we have to negate aspects of the Torah that sometimes you take away in order to build up. That things might have to be eliminated in order for the broader Judaism to survive. It's an argument that it has Talmudic basis, going back to the Mishnah and Brachot. Okay, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi in the codification of the Mishnah, violating the rule of writing down the oral law. What do we say? We have to do it for Judaism to survive. We dispense with one rule to save the great bulk of the religious heritage. Okay.
That was your parsha last week, the weekly parsha, talking about that. As far as writing things
down. Oh, yeah, right, yeah. So
didn't you read it?
I wrote it, but you know, I forget from week to week. I'm working on the Rosh Hashanah essay. You'll get it tonight. By midnight, you'll get it. Okay, so what happens next? The shul in Berlin continues to function until 1823. And then it's shut down. The king, the Prussian monarch, doesn't like it, wants to preserve orthodoxy as the only form of Judaism, because he knows that in the long run, it's not very appealing to the masses of Jews. And so what are they going to do? They'll fall away from their own religion and either become non-denominational nothings or Christians. That's the Prussian attitude. Not every Germanic state would adopt that point of view. Others would say, no, just the opposite. Let them have their watered-down Judaism. Let them, in large numbers, walk away from the tradition, because the watered-down Judaism is just a step along the way to eventual conversion to Christianity.
Didn't that happen to the early Christians in the time of the Second Temple? That for 200 or 300 years they were considered to be Jews.
Quasi-Jewish, yeah.
And then they became Christians.
Right. So it's all a matter of whether the government sees an aesthetically pleasing denomination of Judaism as a real bulwark against apostasy, in which case they would oppose it, or just a hop, skip, and a jump away from another religion. Each state would have its own viewpoint. Yeah.
The heck is it their business?
Okay, so that's an Enlightenment question. In the 1770s and 1780s, the philosophical class addressed that issue. What does it matter to the state, the religious convictions of its citizenry? And the answer is, yeah?
Did you Orthodox go to the Kingdom of Prussia and exert influence?
Oh, absolutely. Next week, we're going to talk about it at length with the Orthodox backlash. Some philosophers believed that it was not a matter of the state to examine the private religious scruples of the individual, and therefore we don't care. Let's have either a separation of church and state, or even if not an absolute separation, no manipulation of the various denominations to serve state ends. Whereas others would say, no, this is a Christian state, And yes, we're no longer living in the Dark Ages like barbarians, and we're going to give certain rights to religious minorities, whether they be Jews or Christian dissenters or Mohammedans or whomever, but we do want to promote the interests of the majority Christian church, whatever be it Catholic or some Protestant denomination, and if that means tinkering with the details of minority religions to serve the agenda of the religious majority, we'll do it. And many, many states and principalities in Central Europe and Western Europe in the 19th century did just that. They interfered. They broke into the synagogue and wanted to know, you're doing this, you're doing that. What kind of customs are you evolving? They really cared. And they would have, you know, like in Roman times, when they would come to see if they were blowing shofar in Rosh Hashanah. Also in Germany, they'd come in to see, are you doing this, are you doing that? Interference. Direct interference. Okay. So, enough with Berlin. What happens next? Reform needs a new home to advance its cause. And it isn't going to be Prussia, because the Prussian government is opposed. It will require a state where the government doesn't care about the internal workings of the Jewish community, and Hamburg fits the bill. Hamburg was an independent city-state in northern Germany, and the Jews were not exactly doing well there because there were Hep riots in 1819, anti-Semitic riots, but the state as an institution was willing to give Jews some wiggle room in their religious behaviors. So, in 1817, there is the establishment of the core, what will develop into the Hamburg Temple. It's dedicated in the fall of 1818. They hire a preacher. They print a prayer book, which is dramatically different from the traditional prayer book. It's printed from left to right, not right to left. Okay, that's already a big change, a very significant change. There is a heavy dose of German, a modest amount of Hebrew. There is separate seating but no machitza. There are preachers giving sermons that are arguably not traditional belief from the pulpit. A wide range of changes similar to that which happened in Berlin.
They have an organ?
They had an organ, yeah. So, the rabbis in Hamburg are up in arms. You can't do this. You know, we're the bosses here. And we say this is no good. What does the chief rabbi say? There is no chief rabbi. Raphael Cohn, who had been the chief rabbi of Hamburg-Altona, resigned in 1799 when he was stripped of the power of the cherem, of excommunication. And he basically said, if I can't impose and enforce religious discipline over my community, as had been the case for centuries, I don't want this job, because it's going to be a mockery. I'll make a pronouncement and no one will listen. Without police power, enforcement power, he felt the office of the chief rabbi is a joke. So who ran religious affairs? The Beit Din. The Hamburg Beit Din for the next 20 years was a team of three rabbis who did their best to officiate at life cycle occasions, issue divorces, and whatever else. And they see this Reform temple, and they say, uh-oh, big problem. We have to stop it. They appeal to the government to shut it down. The government refuses. Why? Because the temple authorities say, we are not competing with or antagonistic to the main community and its synagogue. We are a private association for spiritual purposes. We're not a synagogue. We're not the communal synagogue. We are a separate group, a voluntary group. So now let's just recap, because we're running out of time. In Westphalia, Israel Jacobson tried to impose reform by the force of the government over an unsuspecting and unwilling Orthodox population. In Berlin, okay, they didn't use the force of the government. They just wanted to have equal opportunity in the community as part of the community. And the government shut them down. So in Hamburg, what are they doing? Not part of the community, but separate from. Still not divorcing themselves completely from the main community. They're members, they pay dues, they pay their taxes, but for religious worship purposes, they have a private association. And how could the government interfere in a private association, just because the official synagogue says it's no good? Whose business is it, the official synagogue, that we daven in a slightly different way in our private little shtiebel? That's the argument. Huh?
Is it like an Auschwitz-Gemeinde?
Exactly. Except 60 years later, the Auschwitz-Gemeinde will be the Orthodox, not the Reform. Because the nature of German Jewry will be so radically different a half a century later. So we'll stop here. Next week, we'll go through in great detail how the Hamburg Beit Din sent out a missive, a letter, to all the big rabbis, the heavy hitters in the rabbinate in Central Europe, and said, you got to help us. Write tshuvos, write responsa, condemning as heresy what the Hamburg Temple is doing. And we'll read from Chassam Sofer and all the other heavyweights in the rabbinate what they thought was objectionable about what was going on. See you next week. Gemar Chassima Tova, Shana Tova to everybody. Ksiva Chassima Tova.